Osman warns that any normalization of ties between Islamic countries and Israel would undermine peace and stability in the region. Palestinian groups kick off reconciliation talks in Egypt to unify positions against Israeli occupation. And leaders of West African bloc ECOWAS impose sanctions on Niger over the recent coup in the country, calling on the junta to seize power in 1 week. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran says any new move toward normalization between Islamic countries and Israel would only help the regime intensify its crimes against Palestinians. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said in his weekly presser that the same happened with the previous normalization deals with the regime. The spokesman added that Iran regards any step to recognize Israel and to establish ties with the regime as damaging to the Palestinian cause and regional peace. Kanani said the regime has based its strategy on creating insecurity and instability in the region. The spokesman also pointed to the U.S.'s unwavering support for Israel. He said that Washington has been offering unconditional support to the regime as a top priority. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Leaders of different Palestinian groups and resistance movements in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip have held unity talks in Egypt. A meeting in the city of El Alamein was called by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to create a unified stance to confront the Israeli occupation. Abbas also announced the formation of a committee to continue dialogue and to end divisions. The head of the Political Bureau of Hamas Resistance Movement also attended the meeting. Ismail Haniya called on Abbas to end the Palestinian Authority's political arrest and security collaboration with Israel. The Gaza-based Islamic Jihad movement, however, boycotted the talks. Its head, Ziad al-Nakhala, said the Palestinian Authority must release detained members of the resistance movements in the occupied West Bank before the Islamic Jihad joins the talks. A correspondent from occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joins us to give us the latest on these talks. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer from Bali, Indonesia, who joins us for an analysis. Okay, Mona, first to you. Tell us what has come out of these talks so far.
We have to mention first that the last time President Abbas and the leader of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, the Palestinian factions, had met in Algeria last July, last year, after a five-year gap. This time the Palestinians had met in Egypt in the city of El Alamein. The main issue is to come after this meeting and to declare the end of the division. Only this way the Palestinians will accept this meeting and the previous meetings had succeeded. The end of the division must be declared. Otherwise, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, declared that the formation of a committee to continue the efforts in order to continue the dialogue, to end the divisions, and achieve Palestinian national unity. So after the meeting, there would be a committee to follow up the dialogue and to follow up the issues that had been discussed between Abbas and Haniyeh. Hamas movement at the same time said there is an urgent need for the formation of the Palestinian parliament. A new parliament must be formed. Otherwise, nothing would change. As you have mentioned, the Jihad movement, as well as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, didn't join the Palestinian factions in the reconciliation efforts in the meeting in Egypt. Jihad movement said that they will not take part in the meetings unless the Palestinian Authority releases all the Palestinian prisoners, political prisoners arrested by the PA in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Authority denies that it had arrested any political prisoners, and they say those are arrested on other issues, not political stuff. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine say that the Oslo Accords must immediately end, and that the Palestinian Authority must take other issues in order, or other tracks in order to achieve unity on ground.
Okay, well, Barry Grossman, you know, on the one hand, we can talk about the divisions that do exist between these Palestinian factions, but that is something that at this point in time needs to, I'm guessing, to be given a strong will to eradicate and really pacify whatever differences are between them because of the realities that are on the ground, in particular the way that we're seeing Israel rupture from within. So there needs to be a unified stance in order for there to be any action taken in that regard. How do you see the fact that their talks are taking place, even though there's been a boycott by a couple of the groups in the face of what's happening inside the occupied territories of Israel?
Well, please forgive me for being a bit cynical, but I think the parties come to these talks from a very different position. And Mohammed Abbas, I would argue, comes to these talks from the position of widespread dissatisfaction with him and his party, to the point where he's widely being dismissed as a collaborator, and he needs to shore up his popular support to the extent he can. But he continues to embrace this reality that sees him a champion for non-violent resistance only, and very much opposed to armed resistance. And he takes the position that his party is the only legitimate government in Palestine. So it's hard to see, as a number of Palestinian political scientists are observing, that this is really going to go very far, certainly any further than the deal made last year in August did, albeit that at least this time Abbas is present, whereas last year the agreement was signed by a senior Fatah official on his behalf and contemplated that elections would be held in August of this year, which is clearly not going to happen. On the other hand, Hamas's vision of what needs to take place is impeccable. Let's try to remember that Fatah and the Palestinian Authority was always conceived as a temporary solution born of the Oslo Accords in the 90s. And it's high time they were sent packing. It's high time that an election was held in Palestine without foreign interests pursuing their own agenda, deciding who may and may not stand for election, by, in a political move, designating anyone that would oppose the Palestinian Authority to be a terrorist organization. That's completely absurd when anybody with just a basic understanding of international law recognizes that an occupied people are entitled to engage in armed resistance. So whatever it is that they're doing, it's not terrorism, all right? But Hamas, for its part, is calling on the Palestinian Authority to end security collaboration with the occupation, to release political prisoners and stop arresting them, to create a parliament that represents all of Palestine, to get back to the agenda of establishing a recognized and globally accepted Palestinian state, and to deal with the threat posed by the occupation in those lands which remain occupied. And it's very difficult to argue against that. And my personal view is that Abbas is participating in this because he doesn't have any choice, given the total lack of support that is starting to be felt by him. But having said that, the fact that he's talking about referring this to a committee is worrisome. I mean, there's a quite well-known Palestinian political scientist named Abu Sada. He said, this is no cause for celebration, and the surest way to kill an initiative is to refer it to a committee. And I suspect that's ultimately what Mohammed Abbas is looking to do, while at the same time engaging in a series of appearances designed to garner support for the Palestinian Authority under his rule. He's 87 years old. In many ways, his overstaying any mandate that he might have had in the 90s is highly reminiscent of what Hadi has done in Yemen. I think it's time for him to stand down and go away and let Palestinians that are concerned with Palestine rather than with providing security to the occupation run their own government.
All right, Muna, do you get a sense at all, based on this meeting from even though there were two factions that boycotted it, that there's a sense of urgency perhaps in them uniting in order to face what's happening inside Israel? Because, you know, this is obviously an opportune time for the Palestinian factions to show their unity in order to perhaps want to take some action against the regime forces.
While the Palestinian resistance groups are calling for a comprehensive resistance across the occupied territories, the Palestinian Authority calls for a popular, peaceful, popular struggle and resistance here in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian Authority are saying that there must be one army, one leadership representing all the Palestinians all over the world and inside the occupied territories, and that it's the Palestine Liberation Organization. It's the sole representative of the Palestinians. At the same time, many of the Palestinian factions and mainly Hamas movement say there must be the formation of the parliament, releasing all the prisoners, as your guests have said. So at the same time, while both are trying to convince the people, the Palestinians, that they are doing their utmost in order to end the division on ground, unfortunately, as Palestinian experts are saying, and the people themselves are saying and noticing, everyone wants to be in the position of the leadership, sitting on the chairs, looking at the issues from different perspectives. So for the Israeli occupation, whether we accept it or not, as many have said, the Palestinians are, in a way or another, their enemy. The Palestinian territories are occupied by the Israelis. The Gaza Strip are besieged. The only enemy for the Palestinians is the Israeli occupation. When President Abbas called for this meeting, there was a widespread operation, a large-scale operation in the Jenin refugee camp and city. Over 200 Palestinians had been killed. Destruction had been caused to the city. And people, when we speak about people had been killed, fighters from the different groups, Palestinian citizens, children, women, elderly, unarmed people. So Palestinians, at the end of the day, are being the victim of the Israeli occupation, are continue to pay a very expensive price for this division. So in order to achieve the unity, that is in the interest of all the Palestinians, is to end the division immediately, to both leaders, Abbas and Haniyeh, must declare to the Palestinians that reconciliation efforts had succeeded, and this by we end the division today, and then accept on or achieve the issues that had been discussed, bring it to making it possible for the Palestinians to reform, to form another parliament, to reform the PLO, end any talks with the Israeli authorities, any form of relations with the Israelis, and immediately releasing the prisoners, the political prisoners from the PA prisons here in the occupied West Bank. Whether they declare it or not, there are Palestinians had been arrested by the PA. At the end of the day, they are members of resistance groups. What are the charges against them? these charges might not be clear. However, they are members of the resistance groups. And for the Hamas movement, must at least say that we accept to have one army to speak in the name of the Palestinians as one leadership and one authority.
Thank you for that. Monica Ndil from Occupied Ramallah, and thank you, Barry Grossman, international lawyer from Bali, Indonesia. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. West African leaders have voted to suspend ties with Niger over the military coup in the country. During an emergency meeting in Abuja, the Economic Community of West African States imposed immediate financial sanctions against the coup plotters in Niger. 15, a nation body also threatened the use of force if the junta did not cede power and release the country's elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, from detention within a week. The meeting came amid major pro-junta protests in Niger against any intervention by regional or international powers. Coup supporters also attacked the French embassy in Niamey. The military coup in Niger has drawn worldwide condemnation, including from the UN, the US, Russia, and former colonial power, France. China's vice premier has arrived in Pakistan to attend the 10th anniversary of launching the key China-Pakistan economic corridor. He Lafeng is scheduled to hold talks with senior Pakistani officials during his three-day stay. China's foreign ministry earlier said the visit is aimed at consolidating and deepening strategic partnership with Pakistan. China-Pakistan economic corridor is considered the foundation of China's Belt and Road Initiative. It has seen Beijing invest tens of billions of dollars into Pakistan's infrastructure projects. But many of the projects have been stalled by Islamabad's financial woes, and terrorist attacks on Chinese targets have taken a toll on the partnership. On to Denmark, the government there is saying that it's exploring legal means of stopping protests involving the desecration of holy books following a backlash over recent such incidents in the capital, Copenhagen. The Danish Foreign Ministry cited security concerns and said the measures will be taken within the framework of constitutionally protected freedom of expression. In a separate statement, the Swedish Prime Minister said a similar process was already underway in his country. The number of Quran desecration incidents in both European countries have drawn angry reactions from the Muslim world. Danish and Swedish ambassadors were summoned in several countries, while some others called for the economic and political boycott of Copenhagen and Stockholm. Muslims in Denmark have also slammed the move. The Ukrainian drone has hit a police station in Russia's Bryansk border region, damaging the building. Local authorities said there were no casualties. Ukraine has been recently targeting civilian structures in different parts of Russia by drones. The Russian Defense Ministry says it brought down 44 Ukrainian drones only on Sunday. Moscow has condemned the attacks, saying that they would not be possible without Western aid. The cross-border strikes come as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned of the war coming to Russia. This is what Kiev's biggest ally, the U.S., has distanced itself from the Ukrainian strikes. Washington says it did not encourage or enable the attacks inside Russian territory. Meanwhile, the former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev says that his country would be forced to use nuclear weapons if Ukraine's counteroffensive succeeded in taking Russian territory. Medvedev was referring to Russia's nuclear doctrine that allows the use of nukes in the event of an aggression that threatens the country's existence. Medvedev is now the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council. This is not the first time that he has raised the possibility of a nuclear conflict over Ukraine. In April, he said the likelihood of nuclear weapons being used in the war is growing by the day. Medvedev's latest warning comes as Kiev is trying to retake lost territories and using drones in its cross-border attacks. While Ukraine reports making progress on the front line, Russia says there are no serious battlefield changes. The Ukrainian president has pointed to the recent drone attack as an indicator that the war is coming to Russia. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Whoa. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Afrocom head has said BRICS payment system will replace SWIFT in new non-Western world. Igor Morozov has said the continent will be part of a multipolar world with completely new economic relations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, the unipolar world is collapsing and a multipolar world is being formed with the participation of Africa, where a newly minted middle class will drive consumer demand in the near future. The head of the Coordinating Committee for Economic Cooperation with African Countries, AfroCom, Igor Morozov, told RT recently. Last year alone, 19 African countries applied for BRICS membership because they wanted completely new economic relations, Morozov revealed on the sidelines of the Russia-Africa summit. After the US and the EU seized Russia's forex reserves, the world realized that it is not only a political weapon, but an instrument of financial pressure on the external and internal policy of any country and any continent, according to Morozov. The US dollar has been weaponized, which is why nations will gradually move away from using it in trade, and the BRICS payment system will replace the SWIFT financial messaging network in a new non-Western world. He said, African leaders are also concerned about further use of the dollar and euro. In this regard, the number of countries wishing to join BRICS is growing rapidly because this is an alternative payment system that is due to emerge within half a year. BRICS is pushing towards trade in national currencies and has begun efforts to establish a joint payment network to cut off reliance on the Western financial system, particularly the dollar. Russian trade ties with African countries have been strengthening in recent years, and there is more room for growth, including through free trade zones that are actively developing in African countries, Morozov noted. He stated, "We are ready and we will supply annually through humanitarian aid everything that we have in the agro-industrial complex, our tractors, aggregates, mineral fertilizers, and technologies. We've achieved amazing results in 10 years, and we want to share this experience with our African counterparts." He added that Russia would do everything to ensure the African economy has a future with access to innovative technologies. Meanwhile, one of Russia's top bankers has said alternative payment mechanisms will be addressed very soon. Speaking to journalists on the sidelines of the event in St. Petersburg, Andrei Kostin, the CEO of Russia's second largest bank, VTB, has said that the US dollar had been weaponized, which is why nations will gradually move away from using it in trade. Kostin said structural changes are bound to happen. African countries are also acting on this. They have already started to create their own systems of information exchange and settlements in national currencies. This is a promising trend. He concluded a share of trade settlements in alternative currencies will continue to increase. Russia and its trade partners among the developing nations, such as fellow BRICS members Brazil, China, India, and South Africa, have started to switch to alternative currencies in mutual trade after sanctions effectively cut Moscow off from the Western financial system. A growing number of nations have expressed their support of the trend. President Putin revealed earlier this month that over 80% of transactions between Moscow and its largest trading partner Beijing are settled in rubles and yuan. Russia announced plans earlier this month to launch negotiations on the switch to national currencies with countries in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, namely Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. According to Global Times, as South Africa will host the 15th BRICS Summit in its financial hub, Johannesburg, from August 22nd to 24th, the five BRICS countries, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, will discuss establishing sustainable payment mechanisms for mutual trade among key issues to be discussed at the summit. The move comes as more and more developing countries are seeking alternatives to reduce their dependence on the US dollar. Experts said that the dollar, used as a tool for the US to exercise international hegemony, has resulted in great uncertainty for the recovery of the world economy. The BRICS countries, including Russia, have been seeking to shift further from the dollar in mutual trade, with the de-dollarization trend gaining momentum following Western sanctions that cut Russia off from Western financial mechanisms. South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Nadeli Pandor, said after the BRICS foreign ministers' meeting on June 1st that the new development bank, NDB, is studying the potential use of alternative currencies to the dollar to ensure that we do not become victim to sanctions, Reuters reported.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. And the United States has announced that $345 million weapons package for Taiwan. The total package allotted this year will be $1 billion. And to expedite the delivery, Washington has used what is known as the presidential drawdown authority to pull the weapons and equipment directly from the inventory of the Department of Defense. Now, this procedure has only been used once before, and that was for Ukraine. The question is, why does Washington want to accelerate a conflict with Beijing? Just as Russia had stated that Ukraine was its red line, Beijing has told the United States that Taiwan is its red line and an integral part of China. Does Washington want war with Beijing? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ken Hammond, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University, out of New Mexico. And William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief, Executive Intelligence Review, out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start off with Ken. I mean, where do we begin, Ken? What happened to change the U.S.'s one China policy perspective? Let's start from there, which it had been adhering to more or less for decades.
Well, the shift really in American policy starts about almost 15 years ago, certainly 12 years ago. The United States political elites had anticipated for a couple of decades that China was going to, as it reformed its economy, as it became more integrated with the global economic system, that China was going to go through a political transition, that the Communist Party would somehow be either overthrown or simply become irrelevant, and that China would go through a kind of color revolution, the way that we have seen the United States, you know, pursue these in other countries, and that that would allow China to become a subordinate part of the global capitalist system centered on the United States. But that was never going to happen. That was never China's intention, or you know, they were certainly aware of that danger and did everything they could to avoid that. And as China, by the beginning of the second decade of this century, became more self-confident, became a little more proactive, a little more assertive in its relationship with the rest of the world, resuming the kind of role in global affairs that it historically had played for many, many centuries, American elites turned against China. They said, well, they're not going to join us, so we have to find a way to stop them. We have to find a way to slow down their progress, to, if possible, derail their development. And we get things like President Obama announcing the pivot to Asia, Secretary of State Clinton at that time calling for a new American Pacific century. And that only deepened under the Trump administration with the trade war that was launched, and now the Biden administration pursuing its own very hostile, very aggressive policies towards China. It's basically an issue of the United States fearing the loss of its power, its prestige, its privileges in global affairs, the dominant role it has played as a global hegemon for decades. That's ending, and they don't like that, and so they're trying to find ways to demonize and derail China.
Well, William, I mean, there are a lot of economic relations between the United States and China. I mean, one of the reasons it was said that some American officials were going to Beijing was actually to talk about this, basically this coexistence that they both need to have. So what happened to all of this in the middle of what we're seeing right now and all of a sudden this package being approved?
Well, it's that initiative is not over by any means, although the initiative was not enough to try and to end the crisis between the United States and China, which really came to a tipping point with the visit of Pelosi to Taiwan. Both sides are interested in having these high-level dialogues, but China has made it very clear that it's not simply that we will talk. It's if you want a real relationship, there has to be mutual respect. There has to be win-win cooperation. There has to be a willingness to listen to the other side and to take concern to its core interests, one of which, of course, is Taiwan. The United States has not changed its policy officially. It's still reiterated by most recently by Secretary Blinken in his meetings in Beijing and also by President Biden. Nevertheless, on the ground, what is happening is that there's an attempt to bring Taiwan somehow into the mix of a defense strategy, which is motivated primarily by the U.S. reaction to the success of the Belt and Road Initiative, which has really brought China to the center of world stage and created a lot of goodwill within the global South. This, more than anything else, has been the primary concern of the United States with regard to China's rise, if you will call it that, and that therefore they're taking every measure to defend against this, not by breaking, at this point, not by breaking with the policy of the One China, but by effectively undermining it by trying to arm Taiwan as a fortress in an overall containment strategy which is aimed at China. And if they go too far with this, this will lead to conflict. At the present moment, there's a certain understanding of that, not by all the parties. And we are in a very tenuous situation, which reminds one, you know, very much of what happened just before the Ukraine crisis mm-hmm. and the decision by Russia to move into Ukraine.
Right. Well, Ken, is it possible that there is a divide between the State Department and the Pentagon in the way that the U.S. should deal with China? Or is this just part of a game or strategy? Because, again, we saw American officials go to Beijing and talk about improving ties. And then on the other hand, we see this package, this weapons package, and so many other things going on that has been approved. So is there a divide or not, you think?
Well, I'm not sure that there's necessarily a divide between the State Department and the Pentagon, although certainly the Pentagon is very interested in anything that enhances its influence and its prestige and its ability to, you know, deploy its assets and get more resources constantly, trying to draw more assets to itself. But I think what we've seen has been a pattern of not just rivalry or differences of opinion between maybe separate institutions, but even within the State Department, within the White House, we see one thing being said one day and then something completely different, indeed often totally opposite, being done the next day. Secretary of State Blinken goes to Beijing and reiterates the commitment of the United States to the One China policy and talks about getting conversations going and getting the relationship back on a better pattern. And the next day, President Biden denounces Xi Jinping as a dictator and characterizes China again in this sort of demonic mode. We see, the visit of Kerry, John Kerry, the visit of Janet Yellen. These touted as efforts to get the dialogue going again. And then we have this action of turning around and ramping up arms sales, arms deliveries to Taiwan, and furthering the rhetoric of supporting Taiwan independence.
So why do you think that we're seeing this difference? What's going on in your perspective?
Yeah, no, I think we're seeing very much a difference. And I think that it's what William said is that the United States is not actually willing to break with its relationship with China. The relationship between the countries economically is so profound that it would be devastating to the United States as well as very harmful to China. So they want to put pressure on China. They want to try and force China to maybe devote resources to military activity that otherwise they might devote to further improving the lives of their people, a strategy that they played out against the Soviet Union back in the 1980s with great effect. But that's not going to work because China is already at a much more advanced stage of economic development and much more capable not only of pursuing its own course of improvement, but also, as William was saying, sharing with other countries through initiatives like the Belt and Road. It has a much broader base of international support as well.
Well, William, China has repeatedly said that Taiwan is a part of China and the island is its red line. So let's talk about that. What do you think that means when it says it's its red line?
Well, it means that the post-war situation which was established, the international situation which was created, the structure that was created after World War II, included the fact that the areas that had been occupied by Japan prior to the war and during the war would then be returned to their rightful owners, if you want to put it that way. And in this case, Taiwan was recognized as a part of China, which it had been, you know, for centuries. When the split came and the KMT ended up on the island of Taiwan, the U.S. played a different game since the KMT was calling itself the real representatives of China. The U.S. supported that. But still, considering the fact that Taiwan was a part of China, which the KMT said it was. Later on, however, as China grew, not only economically, but in terms of its political influence, there was more of an attempt to use Taiwan as a hedge against China in the rim, in the Pacific Rim region. Most recently, of course, you have the alliances that are being set up with Japan, with AUKUS, with Australia, trying to get other countries like the Philippines to some extent on board. And Taiwan is a key issue. Most recently, there was a member of the Pentagon, Assistant Secretary of the Pentagon, Ratner, at a hearing where he said that Taiwan represents one of the most important elements in the U.S. defense strategy. Taiwan, of course, is about 100 miles or so off the coast of China, probably as close as Puerto Rico to the United States. And therefore, if the U.S. could use this as a starting point for moves against China, this would be very dangerous in military terms. So that there are two things that are involved there. One is the historical legitimacy of Taiwan being a part of China, which is being insisted upon by the leadership in Beijing. And there's also the defense relationship that if they get if the U.S. has a defense position on the island of Taiwan, it would be like China having a defense position in Puerto Rico. And that would be absolutely unacceptable.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken, William has just talked about the various alliances that the United States is attempting along with its allies and also with the NATO spreading east and dealing with Japan. Tell me about how that affects the whole situation and how do you think that China will have to deal with that?
Well, the United States obviously is trying to bolster its position in the Western Pacific. It's attempting, and not just attempting, it's carrying out a campaign of encircling China, expanding its bases, ramping up its troops, its military deployments in that whole area. This goes right along with the pivot to Asia that Obama announced back in 2011. You know, they're getting Japan to embark upon a course of rearmament, which goes against the fundamental commitments that were made by Japan after the end of World War II. They're carrying out actions like this visit of a nuclear-armed submarine to South Korea, which is a direct provocation both to the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in the north, and to China. And they're encouraging NATO, and of course it's NATO expansion, this relentless move to the east since the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's NATO expansion that has led directly to the war in Ukraine. And now they're trying to push a kind of a neo-NATO expansion into East Asia and Southeast Asia. So this is part of this very, you know, kind of desperate effort by the United States to shore up its position, to maintain its dominant role, to continue to treat the Pacific and the countries around the Pacific as if they're the natural extension of American power, a sort of sphere of influence. They see the Pacific kind of as an American lake, and they want to hang on to that. And so they're trying to shore up these alliances, bolster these defense, as they call it, these military commitments, carry out these kinds of really very provocative actions, in the hope that that will intimidate China or cause China to back off its international posture. And that's simply not going to happen. China is very committed to not only developing its own economy and enhancing the livelihoods of its people, but to providing that kind of assistance to other countries that don't want to be dominated by the United States, don't want to just be incorporated in an American-centered global system. And so things like the BRI or developing other kinds of international institutions to get out from under American domination, I think that's the path that China will really pursue. They don't want to be drawn into some sort of direct confrontation with the United States. They want to go about their business. And I think that that's how they will try to pursue this current situation.
Well, William, is the U.S. trying to use Taiwan as it used Ukraine for expanding its own agenda while sacrificing the population, putting them at risk?
Well, that's the case that exists today. And of course, the Chinese are very much aware of this. There's now a recent exchange of students between the People's Republic and Taiwan and vice versa, which has been mediated by Ma Ying-jeou, who's former head of the KMT, to try and create the kind of people-to-people exchanges which did exist after 1992, after the agreement with Taiwan on the one country, two systems perspective. And they're trying to revive that again. And I think this will be somewhat successful because I think the people in Taiwan feel that they are victims in this and do not want a confrontation because they will be on the front lines of this. Nevertheless, the leadership of the DPP, which still has strong support, as we can see from the polls coming up in the next election, is playing the U.S. card to the hilt. The U.S. is doing whatever it can to try and support this, short of simply abandoning the One China policy. And at a certain point, that can lead to a confrontation. I agree with the former speaker that that's not what China wants to do. That's what they would like to avoid. But there are red lines here. They have said clearly, Declaration of Independence, that is a red line. And I would think that also, to the extent that the United States can build up a defensive wall in Taiwan to prevent an attack by the PRC, I think there would also be a decision made that if they felt this was the last opportunity, there would also be a move in that direction. But I think that the general attitude of the Chinese is that they have international support for the One China policy and generally for their policy with regard to this community of shared interests, which President Xi has been talking about. The global South, which is the global majority, is behind that. The question is, can they mobilize that opinion in such a way to change the chessboard that has now been set up for them, you know, by the U.S. policy?
Well, Kent, it was mentioned that much of this has to do with this change in the world order from the unipolar world to multipolar world, the U.S. losing its reign as the hegemon. So let's look at it from that perspective. Now, William just said that China definitely does not want war, and they would try to do their best to avoid that. What about Washington? If Washington feels so desperate that they're losing this, if we want to say, reign as the number one global power, do you think that we have certain parts of the society or rulers of that society that are willing to do whatever it takes, even if it means war or whatever, just to try to hold on to power, that they think that that's the only way they could do that? How do you see it?
Well, I think that that's a very real danger. I think that, you know, certainly the political rhetoric that comes out of Washington on both sides of the mainstream political perspective, it doesn't matter in Congress if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you know, everyone, there seems to be this is one of the few items of bipartisan agreement in Congress that we should be hostile towards China. And if anything, the only rivalry between the parties is which one can be more can talk tougher and be more macho in the rhetoric about China. And this is a very, very dangerous situation. The kinds of practical activities that the United States is carrying out, the provocations in the South China Sea, the provocations around Taiwan, threatening these sending American warships through the strait, things like that, sending more weapons, sending military advisors to the island. These are all actions, and actions, as we often say here, speak louder than words. So the public rhetorical commitment to retaining the one China policy is one thing. But, when we look at the actual conduct of the American government, it's very, very dangerous. And I fear that there are those either in Congress or in the Pentagon or in the White House who may not really fully understand the seriousness of the danger, the dangerous activities in which they're engaging. China does, as William said, China has red lines, trying to actually separate Taiwan from China, trying to declare Taiwan to be independent, would be one of those red lines. And that could lead to a conflict, an actual military conflict, which would first and foremost be devastating for Taiwan, would be harmful for China, but would also be extremely harmful for the American economy, because our economies, China and the United States, are so deeply interconnected. I don't think that the politicians who are spouting this kind of rhetoric are taking a serious enough effort to understand just how this world today is organized and how it works, because they're flirting with what could be a very, very disastrous outcome for all the peoples involved.
Well, William, just a minute. I have 1 minute or less, actually. Where do you see this going, your prognosis of the near future of Washington-Beijing relations?
Well, I think they probably will continue with the high-level meetings. I certainly hope so. There will be a lot of rhetoric and a lot of things being done, especially in the U.S. Congress, to provoke China. I think that the attitude of the administration basically is to try and avoid a conflict. President Biden probably is in charge, although he's aging rapidly. And the question is if he's really in charge or if it's young Turks that are calling the shots. But I think there and hope that there is enough sense in administration circles to realize where those red lines are. And in spite of the provocations, that they use whatever communications they set up with the Chinese to try and crisis manage, if nothing better, the situation so that it doesn't lead to a military conflict.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Ken Hammond, Professor of East Asian and Global History, New Mexico State University, and William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief, Executive Intelligence Review. Thank you both for being with me. And thank you for joining us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah who is الرحمن Allah who is المنان.
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. We would like to express our condolences on the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful Sahabi or companions. With me in the studio is the guest speaker, Shaykh Rouhani from the Islamic Hawza of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
There is a famous proverb in English language that says, do as you would be done by. We can say, if you do goodness to the others, they will do goodness to you. If you do, we can say, behave negatively with the others, you have to wait for the negative behaviors of the others. Also in Farsi we say anche ke avaz darat gele nadarat. We can say whatever you behave with the others, if it is good, you will be receiving good. If it is bad, you will be receiving bad. Nowadays in the world, the concept of Quran desecration and Quran burning is in the headlines, the toppest news of the Muslim lands, especially in Sweden. We can say the Quran was burned numerously in recent years. This has been done. Is it true from the side of Muslims now to, for example, burn the Bible or burn the Holy Scriptures in order to revenge, for example, Quran desecration? Is such behaviors at all approved by the religion of Islam, Shaykh?
No, never. Because we have a very explicit ayah in the Holy Quran, mm-hmm. which very explicitly orders Muslim not to curse the Ilah or the gods of the other religions, yes. the sacred, let's say, gods of the other religions, because they will curse back your God. So it's a very explicit ayah in the Holy Quran mentioned and tell the Muslims that you have not the right to desecrate the, let's say, God and the those things that they worship.
Yes.
They should not land. They use the term land, which means curse.
Yes.
So it is very explicitly mentioned in the Holy Quran. That's why we see in the history of Islam, we do not find any Muslim who, for example, burned Bible, Torah, Injil, or for example, even Upanishad or the other, let's say, Zoroastrians and Hindus and Buddhists, let's say, sacred books, and none of Muslims burn them. Muslims always respect them, peacefully live together with non-Muslims in the history. We do not see any imam, any prophet who burned, for example, the sacred books of the other nations and other religions.
Yes.
It is not allowed in Islam.
Yes.
Instead, Islam always tell Muslims that you have to respectfully live with the others, with non-Muslims. You have to have a very peaceful life. You have to have tolerance with the others. That is why we see that non-Muslims lived peacefully with Muslims at the time of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. In Medina, we had Jews,
yes.
We had Zoroastrians, we had Christians.
Yes.
In Islamic world nowadays, look, Islamic of Republic of Iran is in a completely Islamic state.
Yes.
Look, we see we have Jews, we have Zoroastrians, we have, let's say, Christians living, Musabi'in living in,
yes,
in Hawaz and the other areas of Iran. So that's why, and also in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Egypt, I don't know, in Arab, for example, world, we in Turkey, we have lots of non-Muslims living with Muslims peacefully while they are under the governance of the Muslims. So it is the history. The history of Islam tells us that Muslims always respected the other religions.
Yes.
Particularly respected the sacred books of the other nations, because it is, you know, it is meaningless. It makes no sense to